Jeff Levering and wife Ashley love their new patio door from Pella Windows and Doors of Wisconsin.
It's like having a brand new kitchen.
I love the roll screen. The fact that the screen is on the inside.
Get 0% interest for up to 48 months. Visit PellaWI.com.
Live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at The Avenue, it's the Jeff Wagner Show. Come join the conversation on the Old National Bank talk and text line at 855-616-1620. Old National Bank. Get old. Now, here's WTMJ's Jeff Wagner.
Good afternoon, Wisconsin. Welcome to springtime in Wisconsin. Yes, looked out my window this morning while I was getting ready for the show at home, and it was snowing. May 1st, and it's snowing. I swear, I think it is so cold it might snow until June. If you watch us on our Listen Live feature and our Watch Live feature, I dug out the winter clothes again. I've got my fleece that I wear in when it's November and December. Now wearing that now because it's just, I tell you, we had those couple really nice days, and it's gone for at least a while. Maybe by next weekend we'll finally get a little bit of spring. All right. Let us get started. Our number is 855-616-1620. That is the Old National Bank talk and text line. I start off the program this week with the adage, be careful what you wish for. Now, late last week, there was the announcement that after years of back and forth, it appears that there is an agreement between the Republicans that control the state assembly and Milwaukee County and the city of Milwaukee, as well as other communities throughout the state. Now, it's the first step, but it's a big step because the assembly is apparently willing to adjust the way shared revenue is handled. Shared revenue, by the way, is money that the state sends back to different communities. So the state collects sales tax, and then the state shares some of it back. And the argument for years has been that Milwaukee County and other communities as well, but Milwaukee County in particular and the city of Milwaukee have been big in pleading poverty, saying that they send all this money to the state and they don't get enough back. And that's been the argument. And for the longest time, the legislature has been hesitant to adjust the formula that they use because candidly, they look at the way they spend money in the city of Milwaukee, and they look at the way they spend money in Milwaukee County, and outstate legislators go, well, why would we send more money back to these people who spend taxpayer dollars in a reckless fashion, in a way that, well, you'd say they spend it like drunken sailors, but that would embarrass drunken sailors. So what's happened is there has been an agreement that they're going to change the formula so more money is going to go back to local communities, including Milwaukee and the city of and the county. Now, in the proposal that's gone through the assembly, at least, there are some restrictions on this. You know, they're going to get more money back, but they're going to have to guarantee minimum levels of police officers. So you can't essentially hold public safety hostage. There's going to be limits. You can't use this money to expand the trolley. Okay, stuff like that. But in general, it's money coming back. And ultimately, this will help. I'm not saying it's going to get it all the way there, but it is going to help, again, fiscal sanity in Milwaukee County and the city of Milwaukee. So that's part of it. It's the shared revenue that's coming back. In addition, for the last, oh, I don't know how many years, people in Milwaukee County, at least the county executive, the mayor of the city of Milwaukee, and all these elected officials have been saying, we want the right to have a referendum on increasing our sales tax. You know, we think if the people of Milwaukee County, for example, want to vote to increase the sales tax, they should have the right to do that. And then we're going to use this money for all these different sort of things. Now, I have parted with the Republicans in the state assembly and the state Senate on their refusal to go along with this. For years, my argument has been, hey, if you've got it's just like the school referendums. If you have taxpayers in a particular school district, or in this case, you've got taxpayers in Milwaukee County who vote to raise the sales tax that's going to affect everybody, but it's primarily going to affect them, I have no problem with it. To me, that's an idea of local control. If the voters want to pay more in taxes, go ahead and do it. And I have been making that argument for years. Hey, and at least For a while, up until recently, the local officials that have been pushing for this have been very, very confident that if they have a binding referendum on the ballot, people will vote for it. Okay, so that's always been my attitude. If the taxpayers want it, they should have the right to do it. Well, in this new legislation that's been proposed, that's precisely what happens. In addition to the adjustment of the shared revenue, what happens is the Milwaukee County voters will be given the opportunity to vote on a binding referendum as to whether they want to increase their sales tax, I believe, by 2% to help pay for government pension programs, public safety, or other operations. So this could theoretically mean a 2% sales tax increase within the city of Milwaukee and a 0.375 increase countywide for Milwaukee County operations. Okay? So the voters get to decide what could be fairer. And it's something that people have wanted for years and years. So you would think that local officials would be, well, just turning handstands because this is what they've been arguing for and this is what they got. Well, be careful what you wish for. Because the story emerging at the end of the week is that now public officials, after years of apparently being very, very confident that if you had a binding referendum, it would pass, now the story is, well, we don't want a referendum. We don't want the voters to be able to decide. We simply want this to be a creature. If the Common Council decides to do this and the mayor signs off on it and the county executive wants to do it and the Board of Supervisors sign off on it, why do we need to involve all those messy voters who might actually say no? Our number is 855-616-1620. That is the old National Bank talk and text line. Now, first of all, I've seen what happens with school referendums around here. My guess is if you put a referendum, a sales tax referendum increase on the ballot, it's going to pass. Okay, I think that's the reality. But the officials, after years of asking for a referendum, now we're saying, well, we don't want one. It might be too complicated. Those voters might not understand it, and it might fail. So let's skip the referendum process. 855-616-1620. All right, should we have a vote? Now, the argument is sometimes when it comes to raising different taxes, you don't have a vote. I mean, the legislature, that's what the Joint Finance Committee is going to decide, what the state income tax should be. We don't have a statewide referendum on this. For school referendums, yeah, if you want to have extra spending, you've got to pass it. So let's tee this up. All right, should Milwaukee, if they want to, and I'm talking about the city and the county, if they want to jack up the sales tax, should the voters have a chance to have direct input on this? 855-616-1620. We discuss in a moment. 855-616-1620, which is the old National Bank talk and text line. And I guess the related question to this is, if they have a referendum in Milwaukee County, will it pass? And my sense is, school referendums pass overwhelmingly all the time. The argument is, well, people might not understand the fact that this is, if they see the word pensions and law enforcement and all this other stuff, they might not understand that. Well, okay, then it seems to me that's the job of the proponents of the sales tax increase to get this through. But, all right, for those of you particularly who live in Milwaukee County, before your sales tax or the city of, before your sales tax, increases 1%, 2%, whatever it is, a tax that once it gets imposed is never going to go away, do you think you should have direct input on that? Or is this just a matter where, what do we care about what the voters think? We'll do it through the Common Council. We'll do it through the Board of Supervisors. And then if people don't like it a couple of years later, they can vote those folks out. 855-616-1620. I'm sorry. I've been listening for years to, we want a referendum. We want a referendum. We want a referendum. We're confident it's going to pass. And now that apparently there is a referendum that could be scheduled, assuming this all goes through as planned, well, now it's like, well, I don't think we necessarily want it. No, I think when it comes to these taxes, just like with the school referendums, this is something that the voters in Milwaukee County should have input on. And my guess is they're going to say yes, but that doesn't mean that you just get them bypassed. 855-616-1620 on our text line. Should you be able to vote on it? Yes, yes, yes. There's no question about this. Jeff, I feel it's funny that the city and county will always bring in the experts out to say how much stuff is going to cost or why we have to spend the money. But isn't it funny that they never have experts look over the books to see how we can save money other than getting rid of police officers? Well, you know, that is the point that we talk about on this program a lot, about how whenever there's an argument that you need money, it's always the most dramatic headline cut that you can have. And the story I always tell is, for years and years, Racine kept trying to get a school referendum passed, and the voters kept saying no, no, no. And so finally what they did in Racine is they said, all right, here's what's going to happen. If we don't get this referendum, we're going to have to do away with the after-school sports. And everybody freaked out. Oh, we're going to be after-school sports. Well, you can't do that. And so it ended up passing. They never said, well, we're going to have to get rid of four mid-level bureaucrats making $130,000 a year plus benefits. No, they didn't do that, because if they said that's where the cuts were going to be, they knew it would go down in flames. So that's why, again, when you have this conversation about these things, and you saw this last week in Milwaukee. Well, if we don't get this money, we're going to have to get rid of police officers, and we're going to have to fire firefighters, and we're going to have to close libraries. You don't have the conversation about, hey, we're going to have to lay off aides that are making $85,000 a year to aldermen or things like that. That's not the conversation that they have. But having said that, there's no question that the shared revenue formulas have been screwed up for a while. There's no question about it. So this is a way of, I think, redistributing money, getting more money back to Milwaukee. I don't have a problem with it, because it does have some controls on it. It says, okay, you can't just completely and totally spend this money in a frivolous way, and money has to be reserved for law enforcement, and money can't be used for this or that or the other thing. I think it's a reasonable compromise. But I also think it's reasonable to say, hey, for years you've been talking about wanting a referendum before you jack up the sales tax. Now we're going to give you the right to have a referendum, and now you're saying, no, I don't want that. Jeff, if I had a choice between buying from two hardware stores, one outside of Milwaukee and one within Milwaukee, with exactly the same prices and exactly the same driving time, yet one was 2% higher due to the sales tax, which one would you buy from? Well, I mean, I think that's the argument that opponents will end up making. Whether or not that's really a driving factor, I mean, if you're going to the hardware store and you're making a $20 purchase, is that 2% really going to cause you to drive to Brookfield as opposed to driving to your neighborhood hardware store? It might be a different factor if you're talking about big ticket items. You know, you're going to buy a $50,000 car. Are you going to buy it in Milwaukee, or are you going to buy it in West Bend or something like that? That might be a factor. But regardless, I think that doesn't change the fact that the voters, I believe, should get the opportunity to decide to do this. And that's the choice that they have. One other question says, what election would this referendum be put on? And my understanding is it could be scheduled as soon as possible. My understanding is it does not have to be timed to coincide with like nonpartisan primaries in February or something like that. So if this were to go through quickly, my understanding is you could have it as soon as the fall or something like that, if you wanted to do that, because that's one of the arguments I've heard. Well, the referendum process, it's going to take time, and if you have to go through and you have to wait a couple months to have an election, I'm sorry, I'm not buying that. Bottom line of all this is, I think a referendum would pass. I understand why they are pushing it, but to me, this is something that just has to happen that way. And to suggest that, well, now we don't need the referendum, we're not going to give voters the input, that's not what people have been urging for years. And candidly, I think it's a non-starter. So if I were to offer any advice to the people who are in favor of this, starting with the mayor and the county executive, I would say you probably should be moving away from the idea of fighting the referendum and spending your time figuring out how you're going to sell the referendum to Milwaukee County or Milwaukee City voters. That's what the challenge is going to be. And candidly, I don't think you're going to have too much trouble doing that once you phrase it in terms that people understand and recognize that people are pretty smart at the end of the day. So So very glad to have you with us. If you follow me on Twitter, it's at JeffWagner620. This is a breaking story. The video is absolutely unbelievable. And I guess my take on this is, once again, what's that they say? Oh, yeah, you can't fix stupid. So here's what happens. There's a 80th and Mill Road near Morse Middle School. All right, so what happens this morning is there's a school bus that's parked on the side of the street. And this video, and I've got a link to it. The video's all over, but I got it off of the Today's TMJ4 website. What you can see happen is there's this Kia. And what do we want to bet that the Kia was stolen? Don't know that. Don't know it, but it's a white Kia. And somebody's got a video of this from, like, down the street. You can see the school bus on the side of the street. And what's happened is that this white Kia is swerving, driving at a relatively high rate of speed, swerving back and forth down the street. And there are people hanging out the windows. So they're hanging out the driver's side window, the passenger side window, as this car is kind of, like, swerving back and forth, driving recklessly. The Kia smashes into the school bus, the rear of the school bus. A passenger falls out of the car. Gee, they were hanging out the window of the car. What's that we say? You can't fix stupid. So they're being dragged to the ground. The car continues on after slamming into the school bus and slams into another car. And again, the video is kind of chilling about this. The driver somehow is able to get out of the car and start to run away. It's amazing that the people who drive in this fashion, look, and I'm not wishing ill on anybody, but it's amazing to me that the people who drive in this reckless kind of fashion, how often is it that they are able to walk away, or in this case, run away from the scenes of the accidents? So anyhow, this video, it's just amazing. If you watch this, it's amazing that more people are not killed in this. Let's see. One person taken to Children's of Wisconsin, another taken to Frederick, other were taken to hospitals via private ambulances. Bottom line is you can't fix stupid. Car smashes into a school bus, all because the car was being driven in a reckless fashion. We'll have to wait and see if the car was stolen, but what do you want to bet the odds are on that? But it's just, you look at this stuff, and the only conclusion you can draw is that, you know, there are people out there that apparently think this is fun to drive in this fashion, and I don't know what it's going to take. I don't know how many more of them are going to have to be seriously injured or killed in collisions like this before they get the idea that this isn't funny. If you want to check it out, again, the video, you can follow me on Twitter. It's at JeffWagner620. I've got a link to the video. And again, the caption is, "You just can't fix stupid." I had one of these comes the dawn moments over the weekend. Oh, I was talking about Friday. I have a little bit of a cold, and I started getting it on Friday, and it's kind of a minor little head cold and stuff. It's not COVID or anything like that. And I went home, went out to dinner with some friends on Friday night. Saturday, I wasn't feeling that great, and so I was looking around the house for some cold medicine. I said to my wife, I said, do we have cold medicine around? She said, yeah, here it is. And I was looking at the different stuff. We had NyQuil and DayQuil. And I found this, we had some Mucinex. And I don't remember ever taking this before. And I took the stuff, and all of a sudden, my head cleared up. It worked. And it was just really, my gosh, this really works in a way that I wasn't used to cold medications working in a while. And I was trying to figure out, gosh, why is this stuff working so well? So I look at the box, and it turns out that this is the good type of cold medicine. It's the stuff that contains pseudoephedrine. Remember, pseudoephedrine is the stuff that used to be in all sorts of cold medication. And then what happened is, years ago, in recognition of the methamphetamine crisis, see, pseudoephedrine is one of the precursor chemicals that you use. You could take chemicals containing pseudoephedrine, and you mix it with other stuff, and you turn it into methamphetamine. Well, if anybody's ever watched Breaking Bad knows that the real, you know, the way you make large amounts of methamphetamine is you have to have like vats and vats of precursor chemicals. And it's true that there might be a tweaker here or there who goes and takes some cold medication and crushes it up and ends up making it. But that's not where most of the methamphetamine that got made got distributed. But in our effort to try to do something, even though it really wasn't going to accomplish much, we said all these cold medications that contain a pseudoephedrine, they can no longer be sold over the counter. At least you can't just go and pull them off the shelves. What you have to do is they have to be kept behind the counter at pharmacies, and pharmacies have to keep a list, and you have to register to be able to buy your drugs with pseudoephedrine in it. And we thought that was going to make a big difference in solving the methamphetamine crisis, and I think most people would recognize that, again, it's been one of these sort of futile gestures that might have sounded good and made people feel good, but really hasn't accomplished anything. Well, apparently, though, I admit I'm as guilty as anybody. When I would have a cold or something, I'd run into, you know, the drugstore and stuff, and I'd grab whatever was on the counter, and I'd go and I'd pay for it and stuff, and it never had that sort of impact. So obviously, my wife, at some point in time, last time she had a cold or whatever, had actually gone through the steps of registering and getting the pseudoephedrine, and we had some in the medicine cabinet, and it made me feel 110% better. It actually worked, which on the one hand reminds me that if you ever have a cold and you want to do this stuff, you might as well just go to the counter, you know, spend that extra 10 minutes, register on the list, and get the good stuff that's going to work. Secondly, we're from the government and we're here to help you. Look, I'm a former drug prosecutor. I understand the impact that illegal drugs in this country's fascination has had on society in general. But this notion that we're going to stop the methamphetamine problem because we're going to make it more difficult for people to buy cold pills, it was always just a frivolous sort of concept. So I fell into that. And it's like, okay, I'm just going to grab the NyQuil. I'm going to grab whatever and buy it. But it didn't have the stuff that actually works in it. So next time you get that spring cold or that summer cold and you want some relief, just take that extra step. And if you're wondering why the stuff they're selling over the counter doesn't work that well, it's because it doesn't have pseudoephedrine in it. And to get that, you need to register. Don't turn it into methamphetamine. Don't sell it to tweakers who are trying to do it. But just take your pill and you will be amazed at how it clears your head. Just, I forgot that stuff. Okay. Years and years ago, when I was practicing, when I was this brief window of time when I was in the private practice of law, I remember deposing a woman, and it was an insurance claim or something like that. And I asked her, you know, where she worked, and she said she wasn't employed now. And then I asked her when the last time she worked was, and she said, well, you know, she had a job for about, 6 months or so, a couple years back. And I said, okay, well, after that, where did you work? No, I didn't work. She was essentially, and this was back in the, this would have been back in the 1990s. She had spent her entire adult life not working. She was on one form of the dole or the other. And I deposed her daughter, who also was part of this claim. And I asked the daughter the same sort of questions. And the daughter, who was, you know, in her mid to late 20s, she had never worked at all. And she had been on welfare her entire life. That's the system that we had in Wisconsin up until Tommy Thompson in the mid-1990s, where we started to say, we are not doing people a favor by essentially allowing them to stay on the dole forever. Because, you provide them with some form of support, you get that. But at the end of the day, they're always then going to be dependent. And you're going to create, in some respects, generational poverty, or at least generational dependence, if you do nothing to inspire people to have to work. And I've always believed that firmly. And so that's why over the last couple decades, and this was not, it wasn't just a Republican Tommy Thompson thing. It was a Bill Clinton Democrat sort of thing as well. This recognition that by not requiring people to do something to better themselves and simply giving them welfare for their entire life, we trap them into this system where they're never going to be able to. It's a system of dependency. They're going to be depending on the government, and they're never going to essentially be able to dig themselves out of whatever hole they're in. And they have really no prospect of a better life beyond simply whatever the dependency of theirs is on the government. So I was thinking about this because as part of the new discussions that they're having about raising the debt ceiling, one of the things is there's a Republican proposal that would require able-bodied adults to work in exchange for welfare like food stamps and Medicaid. And, of course, there are exceptions to this. This doesn't apply to people who are disabled. This doesn't apply to people who have, you know, children who are at home who need childcare. But it essentially says, all right, if you are able to work, what you need to do is you need to be working, or alternatively, you need to be in some form of job training program, attending job training for 20 hours a week, or working as a condition of qualifying for dependents. Here's the deal. More than 4 million Americans aged 18 to 59 who are not disabled and don't have children at home are on food stamps, yet only 1 in 4 are employed. Our number is 855-616-1620. That's the old National Bank talk and text line. Okay, Joe Biden, he's all against this. He says Republicans are cutting benefits for folks that they don't seem to care much about. Here is my question. Are you doing, is the government, are we collectively as a society, are we really doing people favors by creating generational dependency on, you know, government programs? Is it unreasonable to say that as a condition of getting benefits, what you have to do is you either have to be looking for work or you have to work? Now, it might be that you have to kind of, you know, adjust the level for benefits so you don't punish people who are working at minimum wage jobs and all of a sudden they earn so much money that they lose their benefits. So I can understand that you might want to adjust the levels, but a work requirement for various government benefits, is that unreasonable? Is that unfair? The president says it's wacko. Is it really? 855-616-1620. That's the old National Bank talk and text line. I mean, that was the system before we had the Tommy Thompsons of the world and the Bill Clintons of the world in the 1990s. I mean, welfare, you could get on welfare. You could stay on welfare. There's no work requirements at all. You didn't have to do anything to get off of welfare. All right. We have changed that. And now there's some people who want to kind of revert back to where we are. Are we doing people a favor by not requiring them to work or to do something that would try to maybe make them employable? And given the fact that you cannot swing a cat without finding people who are looking to hire people for jobs nowadays, that's the big thing when you talk to employers. They can't find people to work in jobs. Is it unreasonable to say, hey, you know, if you want to have food stamps, that's fine. We're still going to give them. You want these various government benefits, that's great, but you've got to be working. Is that unreasonable? 855-616-1620, we discuss. 855-616-1620, that's the old National Bank talk and text line. Yes, President Biden says it's wacko to require work as a condition of receiving various benefits, whether it's Medicaid benefits or food stamps, etc. And what the Republicans are pushing for nationally, as well as, of course, statewide, is a rule that says, hey, if you're able-bodied, you have to work, or you have to be in some sort of job training. And it doesn't apply to people who are disabled, parents with dependent children, pregnant women, those in drug treatment. But in general, if you can work, you need to be out there working. 855-616-1620. Let's start with Carrie in Columbus. Hi, Carrie. Good afternoon.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you think?
Well, I worked for two different counties administering these programs for 30 years. And I can tell you when I started, my caseload was right around 200. When I retired last year, my caseload was about 850.
Mm-hmm.
I truly believe there should be some work program. And I consider myself a liberal Democrat, and I still think there should be some work program because you need a work ethic.
Right.
And sitting at home, you don't get a work ethic. There's been changes to the programs that I certainly don't agree with for food share benefits, mm-hmm. or food stamps. You no longer have to prove where you live. You no longer have to prove what your rent is, who's living with you, what utilities you pay. It's just all based on your word.
Right. Right. And as a practical matter, there's not enough resources to try to track down the people who might be fudging the information they have. It's just you might catch somebody, but you don't catch the majority of people who might be fudging.
Right. But it's not that difficult when you first apply to bring in a copy of a lease.
Right. Right.
Or to send a copy of a lease or a utility bill. That's not that difficult.
Right.
Also, when I started, there was an asset limit to food stamps, and now there is no asset limit.
Right. Right. Yeah, exactly. So, is that what right you have? But I mean, thanks for calling. I mean, again, the bigger point is, I think it is fair to say that what you do to qualify for these programs needs to be looked at. I also think it's reasonable to say that there has to be a safety net. But what happens is that the stuff, it becomes a soft couch. It doesn't become a safety net. And that's what we saw in the 70s and 80s and 90s. I mean, that was one of the effects of the Great Society programs, where we decided that we were doing people a favor by saying, okay, here, we're going to create a dole, and we're going to give you X amount of money every month. And the truth of the matter is, I don't know if that money was ever going to be enough to lift somebody out of poverty, but you consigned people to poverty. I mean, generations of poverty, because if you don't learn a skill, let's face it, the only way that you're going to better yourself is if you get a job, if you develop a skill. And nobody's saying that, okay, again, for people who physically aren't able to do this, or people who have the child care responsibilities, but if you're an able-bodied 28-year-old, I mean, seriously, why shouldn't you be working, or at least in some sort of training program, to make yourself employable? Or is just the idea, hey, for the next 30 or 40 years of my life, I'm going to sit around and I'm going to hang out waiting for, you know, the government benefits to come in? I just don't believe that it's fair to people to do that, because, again, you trap them into this, okay, I'm never going to be more than I am. And that's never been what this country was founded on. Diane in Chicago. Diane, you're on WTMJ. Hello.
Hi, Jeff. How are you?
I'm good.
I love your reasoning. I think you're 100% right as far as what's the best for people, you know, as far mm-hmm. as learning a skill and bettering themselves. But I have to tell you, there are people who make the coordination of those benefits, that is their life. As far as being educated on welfare and the minimums and food stamps, and the reason Joe Biden says that it's wacko to think that, you know, the government should make someone do something in order to get those benefits, it makes sense from a Democratic point of view. If you have voters who are used to doing nothing and getting, you know, government subsidies, you're looking at their whole voting base and having that kind of disintegrate. I mean, a lot of the Democrats, not like the woman that was just on, but a lot of the Democrats are based on programs to help those who are impoverished, but I think it's gotten way, way out of hand.
Well, right, I mean, Diane, thanks. There's no question there is a political component to this, and there's no question that there are segments of society who say, okay, look, here's the deal. If you are cruel and you are heartless, if you decide that you want to attach strings to these different benefit programs, well, I would argue, you know, Diane, that it's cruel and heartless to not attach some sort of strings to this. Nobody's talking about denying people benefits, but at the same time, I think it is cruel and heartless to trap people into a system of poverty where, okay, here's the deal, you're able-bodied, you could be working, Nobody argues that you couldn't be working. You could be working, but we're not going to incentivize work. So you have no chance of, I don't care where you're going to get a job, getting a job in a retail store and working your way up. You have no obligation and no chance of bettering yourself, which pretty much guarantees that you're never going to do better than whatever it is that the taxpayers are going to give you. And I would argue that that is not necessarily helping people. At least it's not helping people in the big picture. So Joe Biden says it's wacko. Maybe it's wacko from his political perspective. But if you want to encourage everybody to do the best that they can, what you need to do is you need to put some requirements on so we don't have the welfare system that we had in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s and the 90s, which turned into a complete disaster. This is not the time to go back to that future.
Live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at The Avenue, it's the Jeff Wagner Show. Now, here's WTMJ's Jeff Wagner.
Good afternoon, Wisconsin. Welcome back to the show. Well, all right, I'm not even going to say I told you so, because in the scheme of like different predictions that you can make, some predictions are hard, others not so difficult. And we've been talking since the beginning of the program about this incident that happened about 9 o'clock this morning outside a middle school in on like 80th and Green Tree, Morse Middle School. So it's sort of between, if you know Milwaukee, it's between like Mill Road and Good Hope Road. That's where it is. And what happens is there's a school bus that's parked on the side of the street, and it's got kids that are in it. I don't know if it's unloading kids or loading kids or whatever. What you can see from this video, and if you want to see the video, I've got a link to it. If you follow me on Twitter, it's at Jeff Wagner 620. There's a white Kia that turns onto 80th Street, and you can see it swerving back and forth. And there's people hanging out the windows of the car, hanging out the driver's side window, hanging out the passenger window, and clearly these are people on a joyride. It's a white Kia. I said in the last hour of the program that my guess was that it was stolen. They have now confirmed it's stolen. Okay, so it's a stolen car. Apparently, there's a guy who works for the city of Milwaukee or something who had seen this car before driving in this erratic fashion, and it started filming it. That's why they've got these films of this. Well, anyhow, you watch this video. So the car comes around 80th Street, swerving back and forth. You got kids that are hanging out the windows of the car. The car smashes into the driver's side rear of the school bus. All right, an 11-year-old who was on the bus has now been taken to the local hospital with, thankfully, non-life-threatening injuries. And you can kind of see on the video what happens is one of the idiots who is in the passenger side of the car, I think one of the people hanging out the window, they get thrown from the car. And that's, by the way, how you typically die. You typically die in automobile accidents when you get thrown from the cars. That's why, I mean, people get injured in all sorts of fashions, and I understand that you can, you know, lose your life if you're still within the cabin of the car. But they have all these safety measures that are built in. That's why it's so important for people to wear seatbelts, because you got airbags and all that other stuff. But once you get thrown from the car, you are very, very exposed. So there's a 15-year-old who is in the vehicle that struck the bus. So this is one of the people, I presume it was the kid who was hanging out of the passenger side window, because you can kind of see that kid gets thrown from the car and then dragged. 15-year-old in that vehicle, taken to the local hospital with life-threatening injuries. And then if you watch the video, what happens is after it smashes into the bus at a high rate of speed, the momentum keeps the car moving forward, and it bangs into another car. Like, I think it's like this Mercedes or something that's parked on the other side of the school bus. But what you can see is after smashing into the school bus, while the car is still moving forward, you have these people, including the driver of the car, who get out and they start to run. And at least my understanding is right now that they are still at large. Several other occupants of the vehicle fled the scene on foot. Police say the vehicle they were in was stolen. So You've got the 15-year-old who was seriously injured, who was in the car, and presumably they're going to figure out who it was that was in this car. But I think it's fair to say that, once again, 9 o'clock on a Monday morning, you've got a bunch of kids from Milwaukee who are joyriding in a stolen car, driving in a dangerous fashion, smash into a school bus. The miracle is that nobody on that school bus was killed, and the miracle is that it appears that nobody in the car that was driving in that fashion was killed, although at least one is injured. My guess is, since they caught the one, they'll be able to figure out who the other people were that were in the car. But it's another one. It's 9 o'clock in the morning, for God's sake. It's 9 o'clock in the morning on a school day, and you've got, all right, we only know that it's one 15-year-old, but I think it is probably fair to say that there weren't 25 and 30-year-olds. This was a bunch of teenagers joyriding in a stolen car at 9 o'clock in the morning, driving in a reckless fashion, who have now caused all these problems. Our number is 855-616-1620. That is the Old National Bank talk and text line. Here's, I guess, my take on this, and I feel bad. I don't want to sound like a broken record on this stuff, but I'm sick of it, and I think all of us should be sick of it. If you're the parent of that 11-year-old or any of the other kids who's on the school bus, and you watch this video, you think, these fill-in-the-blanks, these punks, they could have killed our kids. You know, we don't have school seatbelts on school buses, and so you've got an 11-year-old that's thrown, you know, somewhere because of the impact, and it could have been a lot worse. And then, of course, you have people who have no regard for anything, so these kids get out and they run and they flee. Oh, we smashed into a school bus. We've left one of our friends behind, might be dead, you know, might be, you know, injured for life, might be disabled for life. We're going to bail on them. We're just going to go run to protect ourselves. When they figure out who these kids are, and they will figure out who these kids are, is there any reason at all why every one of them who is in that car, including the kid who was hanging out the window of the stolen car, is there any reason in the world why all of them shouldn't be in juvenile detention? I don't know, 3 months, 6 months, a year, whatever. But they're in the stolen car. They're joyriding. They're driving in a reckless fashion. Yes, do you only go after the driver? Bull. Because if the driver didn't have everybody else in the car egging him on, none of this would have happened. The fact that we refuse to hold people, kids in this case, accountable for things like this is putting all the rest of us at risk. And we're building a new juvenile detention facility that's only got 32 beds. How crazy is that? Every one of these kids in that car this morning who did what they did and then fled, every single one of them shouldn't be sent back to their parents. Every single one of them, at least for the next 3, 6, 12 months, should be in some form of juvenile lockup. 855-616-1620. And until we recognize that and start dealing with that, and maybe even you look at waving the driver into adult court, I don't know, but there needs to be consequences, and there's no consequences, period. We start by holding every one of those kids in the car accountable, including the kid that's in the hospital. 855-616-1620. What do you think? 855-616-1620, which is the Old National Bank talk and text line. I mean, I swear, you cannot make this stuff up, and you know, and we can talk about it, but it is that old adage where a picture is worth a thousand words. You look at the video of what happened at 9 o'clock this morning outside of a middle school in Milwaukee, and you see the school bus that's parked. You see this car swerving back and forth that slams into the school bus. Kids hanging out the windows of this car, which, no surprise, turns out to be stolen, smashes into the car. One of the kids in the car gets thrown and then dragged by the car. He or she is in the hospital. And then everybody else, the car is still moving. They're jumping out of the car. They're running like they think they're going to get away from this. And maybe they get away short term. Ultimately, I'm confident authorities will catch them. But, of course, the question becomes, once authorities do catch them, you know, what ends up happening? You know, what ends up happening? And if it's just, we're going to slap them on the wrist, tell them don't steal cars and don't go on joyrides at 9 o'clock in the morning, you're not going to accomplish anything at all. The only way you get these punks' attention is by, I don't know, sending them to some juvenile detention facility for 3 months or 6 months or a year or whatever. Jeff, aside from charging them and putting them away, I think insurance companies need to step up and refuse to insure Kia cars until they put that mechanism in place to solve the problem. Well, that's a different sort of story, but the bottom line is, in this case, whoever it was that stole it, and then everybody in that car that's taking it on a joyride, why do they think it's okay? And where are the parents in doing something like this? Jeff, every single one of those kids should be locked up in a juvenile facility. Moreover, they should not be building that possibly closer to Milwaukee. It should be located at the very top of the state. It's not summer camp where your friends and family can come visit you. Jeff, nothing is going to change in the city until the police are allowed to do their job, and until the district attorney starts charging these criminals, and the criminals get put in jail or prison. Otherwise, your frustrations aside, all you do is just read about the activities every day. There's no question about it. You know, Jeff, it's so sad. You see it on TV, and it's never brought up by elected officials. Why were these kids not in school? If we don't start as a society to not only hold the kids accountable, but start tackling the reasons why we are losing generation of generation down the same downward spiral, people always comment, when will this end? Well, the truth is, it'll never end. If we don't start tackling both punishment for consequences and ending this cycle of behavior that's happening every generation. Let's start with Nancy in Burlington. Nancy, good afternoon. You're on WTMJ.
Hi, Jeff. I'm good. Try it out. Tone down my language and not be so angry. But as the mama of a kid who bailed out of a car 5 years ago and died, I think all of his, but this poor kid who got flighted to freighter today, his buddies should go up to the neuro ICU and see their buddy with a swollen head and a pressure device in his brain and on a vent and learn about what happens when you're on a vent, develop a big GI bleed. They should see the pain they caused this kid's parent, and then they should see the results of what happens when you're severely brain injured from doing stupid things in cars. That the pain is terrible. They're so impulsive. Their frontal lobes aren't developed. They don't think they're ever going to die.
Mm-hmm.
But there has to be severe punishment. And they should, the media should talk to the parents and let them see what they're walking through.
Yeah, I just... And of course, you've got the 15-year-old that was thrown from the car, who was hanging out. You've got there's an 11-year-old who's on the school bus that's hit by this.
That's just horrible.
It's just so frustrating. And stuff like this, Nancy, I guess that what's really frustrating is this is not an anomaly. It happens all the time. Now, in this particular case, we've got
boys,
this video. Yeah.
And it's boys who think they're going to live forever. And when they see their friend vented in the neuro ICU, maybe that'll change things.
Yeah, Nancy. I don't know either. Thanks for calling. I'm sorry for your loss. I understand people are impulsive, and your story is that object lesson about the horrible things that can happen when people make these incredibly bad decisions. Now, I don't know all the circumstances behind what happened to your son, but in this case, you've got kids who are in a stolen car. They know that it's a stolen car. Okay, I'm just like I knew that the car itself was stolen. I will bet you dollars to donuts, all these kids knew it was a stolen car. Now, whether they all stole the car or not, I don't know about that, but they know that they're joyriding in a stolen car. They're hanging out the windows of the car, so they're celebrating the fact that here, we're driving recklessly in this stolen car. Look at us, so you've got that going on. And I'm willing to bet that there's nobody that was in that car that was willing to take responsibility. Because, by the way, if any of them had, they wouldn't have run. But that's it. Okay, we've now smashed this car. We're now going to run. And, it is interesting. You'd wonder what these punks are doing They got away for a minute. Now, what are they doing right now? Okay, so this happened about 9 o'clock, so it's 4.5 hours later. Now, what have they been doing for the last couple hours, knowing that one of their friends is in the hospital because of their behavior, knowing that they put an 11-year-old kid in the hospital as well, and knowing that the cops are looking at them? You know, what's going through their minds? 855-616-1620. We continue the conversation in a moment. Jeff, I'm the mother of a 25-year-old who's in prison today because his juvenile behavior, he never got punished. The court system really needs to start holding accountable minors. Everybody's saying, where are the parents? I'm a parent that actually called the cops on my own son, and nothing happens. The problem is the system. Well, I think there's an element to that. It's like we were talking about, you know, in the earlier segment. I don't think you do people a favor by saying, okay, we're not going to make you work. We're not going to make you do anything to better yourself. Sit on your butt, and here we're going to give you benefits. We're going to trap you into a generation of essentially being on the dole. I don't think you're doing people a favor by doing that. I similarly don't think you're doing people a favor when you mess up as a kid by just having a system turn its back on you. Well, you know, you're just misunderstood. Well, nuts to that. If you're stealing cars and you're crashing cars and you're creating all this havoc and you do it over and over and over again and you're never held accountable, what lesson does that send you? Well, I'll tell you what it sends to you. You keep doing it until finally you do something that is so bad that then you end up going off to prison for a lengthy period of time. I don't know if putting people in jail for misbehavior works, but I know not putting them in people in jail, you know, doesn't work. Let's talk to Ken on the Northwest side. Ken, good afternoon.
Hi, how you doing?
Hi, Ken.
Hi. I'm a frequent listener. I remember quite a few years ago, a kid in a foreign country vandalized some cars. And the judge, he went to court, and the judge says you're going to get 50 strikes across the rear end with a bamboo switch.
Like the caning, yeah.
And then they reduced it down to 25. Maybe we need to do that, but then the parents will be complaining about child abuse.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, I guess, corporal punishment is a whole other kind of conversation. I just like there to be some form of punishment. I mean, just some form of punishment somewhere, sometime, to try to hold people accountable, because we don't do that. And as long as that continues, you're going to have more stories like this. And what really is going to hit home is you will have a chance to see this video, because it's going to be all over the TV news. And again, if you want to get a head start on it, follow me on Twitter. It's at JeffWagner620. But you'll be able to see how reckless this is. You look at this, and the real surprise when you see this crash is that only one kid on the bus is in the hospital, and only one of the punks that was in the car ends up apparently being in the hospital, and the others are, you know, on the lam right now. One of our texters, I speculate, you know, what are they thinking? One says they're eating cheeseburgers and trying to figure out the next car to steal. Well, that might very well be the case. Not your best ad lib. Not your best ad lib. Yeah, it's like okay. Otherwise, it's a fine day. It's about it's May 1st. It's cold. It's
winter
snowing.
Mixes.
Yeah, it's snowing. Yeah. No, it's May 1st.
I know.
That's
I know.
It. Hey, all right. Speaking of time passing, do you remember that robbery of the armored car? Remember that it was delivering the money to the bank and it got it was robbed on 79th and Capitol?
That was a long time ago.
Well, that's it. I was just pulling up the dates because it's kind of like I have a tickler on these things. It was January 26th, over 3 months ago. You have people that rob an armored car, get over $100,000. And I mean, that's a big deal because you're going federal. You've got the FBI involved and all that sort of stuff. It's been more than 3 months and they still made no arrests on that. How can you rob an armored car and get away for this long with the FBI looking for you and local police and all this?
Who knows? Maybe they'll come. Maybe they'll catch him tomorrow you just brought it up.
Right. Maybe they'll catch. Well, I try to remind people this because it's kind of been in the back of my mind. It's like, all right, you know, you rob You rob banks, and they catch the people that end up doing this. You rob an armored car at 8:15 in the morning. You'd think that...
On Capitol Drive.
You'd think that somebody... Well, obviously, there are people who know who did it. You know, it's not just the people who did it, but there are people who know that, hey, Eric and Jeff knocked over this armored car. I mean, they're, 'cause people talk, and presumably have family or friends that know that, hey, they come back and they're rolling in these dough, and nobody's been willing to come forward. So they're at large for over 3 months.
Just as long as it doesn't happen again. Let's hope they...
Oh, right. So they spend the money, right? So they blow through all the money that they have, and then they want to rob another truck. Well, that actually, see, I had got a story. Well, okay, one of the first bank robberies I prosecuted was back in the day. This is back in the 80s. Was these four guys robbed the Cudahy Marine Bank, and they got into the safe. It sounds silly, but there's really no money in banks because what happens is the tellers have limits as to how much cash they can have in their drawers, and the safe is locked. Mm-hmm, and so, and so, as a general rule, I mean, robbing banks, it's just, you know, there's cameras, there's federal, there's security, there's all this stuff, and there's really not a lot of money in banks. Well, these four idiots hit the bank right. They had just opened up the safe, you know. So the safe, I mean, the safe happened to be open for at least 5 minutes when these guys went in.
It was just
happenstance. So they got away with. Hundreds of thousands of dollars, and it was the largest bank robbery in state history, at least at the time. Okay, so then they've robbed this. So what do you do? And so these guys went on the lam, and they're all together. They didn't really necessarily like each other, and then the money goes. I mean, they spent it. So, okay, it's 3 months later. You're now down in South Padre Island, Texas. You're broke because you've spent all this money, but you know that the authorities are still looking at you. So what do? You try to rob another bank. That's what happened. And they got caught, and then it all kind of, you know, fell apart. But it was like, wow, you know, what do you do after you get away with this? Because at some point in time, you got to surface with the money or whatever. So I am hopeful that they catch these guys. I still remember the names of the guys that robbed the bank.
Is that right?
It sticks with me. You know, I remember it was like a week long trial and stuff like that.
You ever follow up on them? Find out what they're up to today.
Well,
they're still behind bars.
No, they're probably all out. But they were. There was the trial was in front of former the late federal judge Robert Warren, and he was not amused by this. And they were. I mean, they all went to prison for like 20-25 years. No, well. I mean, it was a big deal. They walked in with guns and stuck guns in the faces of some of these tellers and stuff, and really traumatized them. And it was just dumb luck that they got away with as much money as they had. So the bottom line is, you always get caught sooner or later. These guys that robbed this, but you're right. The bigger point is, you hope they catch them before they rob something else, because whenever you do an armed robbery like this, there's always the potential that you can get away not just with money, but you end up killing somebody or something like that. So, but it's been 3 months, over 3 months. All right, there you go. When we come back, I'm from the government. I want your lawnmower. Stick around. So, very glad to have you with us. Yes, I was telling my producer, Charlie, I'm a font of life advice. Don't rob banks. I mean, it just don't rob anything. But for people who think, oh, I'm going to be a bank robber, because you've seen it glorified in TV shows or in movies or whatever, don't rob banks. I mean, there's not a lot of money in banks. And I know that sounds stupid, but it's just with the rules that they have. And don't rob banks. Don't rob anything. Don't rob grocery stores. Don't rob convenience stores. Don't rob banks. It's not worth it. It's just not. And don't steal cars and drive 90 miles an hour and hang out the window of cars. Now they've up the kid, the 15-year-old who was hanging out the passenger side of that car that slammed into the school bus. They've now said he's in critical condition. It's a horrible story. And then, of course, all his friends, and if you're watching us on our live stream video, I'm making the air quote mode, all his friends, after he gets thrown from the car, what do? They run like the cockroaches that they are and flee, leaving, you know, their buddy behind. I mean, with friends like that, give me a break. Okay, I want to revisit something we've talked about in the last week or two, because it is back in the news again. There, the government has decided, of course, that there's all sorts of things that we use and we like that we shouldn't be able to use anymore. You have various governments, various local governments that are in the process of banning new construction that has gas stoves, new construction that has natural gas forced air furnaces. You have the Consumer Product Safety Commission, which is already starting to weigh in. First, they said, well, you know, we think that we got to get rid of gas stoves. And then when there was a blowback, they said, okay, we'll rethink this. In Wisconsin, there's been some legislation that's moving its way through the Republican-controlled legislature, which would prohibit municipalities from banning small engines. So essentially, gas-powered lawnmowers, gas-powered leaf blowers, gas-powered weed whackers, et cetera, and ultimately automobiles that are powered by the internal combustion engine. One of the arguments that some of the Democrats who oppose this were making is saying, oh, this is just feel-good stuff. Nobody would ever try to do that. Big fawning story in USA Today. Gas leaf blowers and lawnmowers are shockingly bad for the planet. Bans are beginning to spread. And then it's this kind of puff piece that talks about how if you care about the planet, you will get rid of your gasoline-powered lawnmower. You will get rid of your gasoline-powered leaf blower. It talks about California already taking the biggest step in banning engines. Their ban phases in next year and prohibits the sale of new small gas engines. You can keep using the ones you own, but no new ones. Washington, D.C. has a stricter ban. You cannot use a gas-powered leaf blower effective last January, and there's $500 fines. Denver area regulators are considering restrictions that target municipal users but will allow homeowners at least temporarily. And then it goes on and on to talk about how, well, don't you understand that if you love the planet, you know, you won't be contributing to noise pollution and you won't be, again, having these emissions coming from the lawnmowers. Our number is 855-616-1620. That is the Old National Bank talk and text line. These are the types of things that, again, drive me crazy when it comes to, you know, Big Brother and the government deciding that it knows better than us. Now, it starts with big things like Joe Biden's efforts to try to force us out of gasoline-powered cars, despite the fact that the technology just is not there and the infrastructure is not there for electric cars. But this is the thing that sounds good. So we're also, if you've got a gasoline power, if you like gasoline powered lawnmowers, we're the government. We don't think you should have it. If you like your gasoline powered leaf blower, we're the government. We don't think you should have it. Explain to me seriously how, for example, all the people that do maintenance, you know, the landscape companies. All right, so you've got your leaf blower and you charge it up in the morning, and that's great. And then you go out and you show up at a condo complex and you do 14 yards, and then you've got to go to the next condo complex and do another 30 yards. How are you going to be able to do that without taking the time to recharge it? It's not practical. As far as people who like their lawnmowers that are powered by these small engines. Look, I love the planet as well as the next person, but I think this should be a market-driven thing. And if there's, you know, you can convince people you should give up your lawn boy. You know, give up that lawn boy, that two-stage where you got to mix the oil and the gas and things like that. That's fine. And if people choose to do it, that's great. But I just don't think any of us should be forced by any local municipality or a state government to give up our lawnmowers or our weed whackers or our leaf blowers or our snow blowers or snow throwers. If you want to have a gasoline-powered small engine device, to me, it's not the government's responsibility to tell you that you cannot. And as far as the costs, well, all right, there's all sorts of different costs that are involved. Maybe someday people will decide that they want to go that route, but I don't think government should be telling you that you've got to get rid of your lawnmower. Yet that is precisely the direction that we are moving in many communities. 855-616-1620, that's the Old National Bank talk and text line. Your small engines, all right, Should the government force you to give them up, or at the very least, prevent you from buying a new lawnmower, a new leaf blower, a new snow thrower, a new snow blower, fill in the blank, if it's powered by a gasoline-powered engine? 855-616-1620. We discuss in a moment. 855-616-1620, which is the old National Bank talk and text line. Jeff, first of all, I agree with you. It's not a function of government. But do you remember back in the 60s and 70s when the big push was to save a tree and use plastic bags at the grocery store? Now it's use the paper bags and save the planet. How long before they require gas-powered engines because the batteries are starting to be too much of a garbage problem and they can't properly be disposed of? Well, that's... right, that's the thing. Or where are we going to get the lithium? Or, you know, the people are going to say, look at what they're having to do to mine the lithium that they use for the batteries, and this is destroying the planet as well. Kind of, it all flips around. Let's talk to Aretha in Milwaukee. You're on WTMJ. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
What do you think?
Well, I don't think that the government should mandate it, but I do think that it's a good idea. I know your argument about having maintenance crews that do your apartment complexes. I know that the one behind us that does our property uses electric lawnmowers and battery blowers. It cuts down on the noise. They're there for hours and hours, and I appreciate it because it really does make a difference because they're there for so long, and it just, the noise is a lot less.
Yeah.
So that's my only argument, is that it can be done.
Well, yeah, and I wonder how they do it. I wonder if they've got like backup batteries that they switch out or something like that. I mean, I wonder how long that they do it, and I don't know. Yeah, no, thanks. This is the argument I make when it comes to everything ranging from electric cars to gas stoves or whatever. I'm a free market guy. There are certainly arguments that you can make as to why it's better to use these electric powered devices, and the best one is the quiet. I mean, I think, you know, it's much quieter than having the sound of the lawnmowers and stuff, and I appreciate that, and that's sort of an argument, and maybe that's an argument, for example, if you're signing a maintenance contract with on your condo board or whatever, or you're hiring a lawn service or whatever, and maybe that's an argument. Hey, you know, what kind of mowers are you going to use? Do you use electric mowers, or do you use, you know, the gasoline powered motors? Because we know you're going to be here for a couple hours whenever you cut the lawns, and you know the residents don't like it because it's louder. And maybe that's an argument, and maybe it's a kind of a free market thing. Now, I'm on our condo board, and when we look at our landscaping contract every year, I will tell you, that hasn't been the issue that comes up. It's, first of all, finding places that are willing to come out and do those services, and then, you know, how much are they going to charge? I haven't ever gotten to the point of, like, saying, okay, well, what kind of mowers are you going to use, et cetera. I'm just glad that you can have somebody that shows up every week and does the job in a good fashion, and how they get it done, really, it doesn't bother me. But, again, it's a free market sort of thing, and I appreciate that. And that's something that moving on, you know, maybe the technology is going to be such that the chargers will last longer, or maybe the price is going to drop so much that it makes sense to use the electric lawnmowers. And that's all well and good. It's a free market sort of thing. I just don't think the government should be in the interest of, oh, gee, you know, we want to try to save the planet, so, you know, we're going to try to do it one lawnmower at a time, when you've got India and China that are becoming more and more industrialized, and they're doing it by putting up giant coal-fired power plants, but we're going to do it one lawnmower at a time. Give me a break. This is a classic example, and you're seeing it play out over the last couple of days, of what is, in some respects, it's the most insidious kind of media bias. It's the bias by omission. Sometimes the bias is overt. You know, it's the way a story is written. For example, the New York Times during the Trump years, and, you know, they, 95% of the stories were written in a negative fashion to Donald Trump. Because even if they did something he liked, they didn't like Trump. So that was the slant that the story had. But the more insidious kind of bias is the bias by omission. That is, we're not going to tell you some of the facts because they don't coincide with the narrative that we want. So over the weekend, you had the story, actually from outside of Houston, Texas. You have the guy who shot shot and killed five people, including a child, and is now on the run. And, you know, it's just, it's a horrible story. And it's, you know, there's a dangerous guy that is on the run. Well, the interesting detail that has been, if not completely overlooked, but has been buried in most of the stories, is the fact that the guy who shot the people in Texas is himself an illegal alien who has been deported five or more times. Now, the New York Times is a big story about this. You've got to read two-thirds of the way through the story, and then you see one sentence saying, the governor says he was here illegally, in the country illegally. You know, and again, it doesn't fit the narrative because, you know, we don't want to give out a message that some of the people who are in this country illegally may, in fact, be dangerous. But and you can argue about how significant it is. Now, I would argue that if you've got somebody in this country illegally who's been deported five times, instead of simply giving up on it, that this is one of the reasons why we should continue to try to aggressively punish people who come back in the country after deportation and then send them back, because they can act out and do some things like this. But I think, especially given the fact that he is at large, and, I mean, who knows where he is, but it's probably 50-50 that he's now gone back to Mexico, which is, you know, he's a Mexican national, which will make the of catching him, if that's in fact what happened, a lot more difficult. But, you know, if you just read a lot of the accounts and watched with some of the stuff on the mainstream news, you would never know that this guy who's murdered all these people was in this country illegally. Again, it doesn't fit the narrative. A lot of great stuff coming up in the 2 o'clock hour of the program. Don't go anywhere.
Live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at The Avenue, it's the Jeff Wagner Show. Now, here's WTMJ's Jeff Wagner.
Good afternoon, Wisconsin. Welcome to the show. There are bad ideas, and then there's bad ideas with hair on them. This is a bad idea with hair on it. The former Burnett County prosecutor. Here's the story. Daniel Stephan of Osceola will face up to 10.5 years in prison and fines of up to $30,000 for 3 felony counts of representations depicting nudity. He's a former assistant district attorney in Burnett County. A witness told investigators in early 2020, a woman she knew talked openly about having sex with Stephan in exchange for leniency in her criminal cases, according to the criminal complaint. So the guy's a prosecutor who says, okay, I'll give you a break if you have sex with me. The woman was in jail when investigators began looking into this matter. Huh, what could go wrong with this? The woman denied having a relationship with Stephan and said she'd only met him in court. 3 months later, the woman was questioned again at her home and admitted she'd had sex with Stephan multiple times at his home and in his office during work hours. Huh, during work hours. Wonder what's going on in the Burnett County District Attorney's office. The State Division of Criminal Investigation later got a warrant to search Stephan's home, where investigators found an iPad that had 2 videos of him having sex with the victim. A third video on the device showed him having sex with another woman. Each woman told investigators they were not aware that they had been recorded and did not consent to be recorded in the videos. Both videos were dated from 2018. In a February 2018 video involving the second woman, she and Stephan can be heard discussing how she might avoid criminal charges for driving into a mailbox. Oh, okay. Now, there's bad judgment, like I say, and then there's bad judgment with hair on it. You are a prosecutor, and you decide that it's going to be a good idea that you are going to, again, use your influence, your power, to have sex with one of the people that you are supposed to be prosecuting. Gee, what could possibly go wrong with that, you know? All right, but then it gets better. Not only do you go ahead and have sex with the person who should be a defendant in the case in exchange for leniency or whatever, but you film it without their knowledge. Here, let's create evidence of what I've done. I mean, you want to talk about just number one, you know, felony behavior, period. Okay. But then, you know, just felony stupid. All right, we're going to do this, but then I'm going to film it without your knowledge, and then I'm going to keep it on my iPad. It is just the amount of bad judgment and criminal judgment here is absolutely staggering. Story out of West Bend, and I don't know what the answer is, but it's another one of these situations where we have swatting. You know, swatting is the process of someone calls, and typically it's done directed at schools. They've had a huge problem in Illinois this year. We had a problem in Wisconsin last year, and as we get closer to the end of the school year in June, it tends to pick up. But swatting refers to like the SWAT teams. It refers to, you know, somebody will call and say, I'm in such and such school. I've just shot three people, and I'm going to kill more. Or there's just been a mass shooting. There's a guy with a gun in such and such school. And then what happens is the police have to drop everything, understandably, and they have to respond. It's a big deal. But there's people out there who think it's fun to do, I guess, and get some sort of weird kick out of it. And a lot of times the calls are originated from overseas or whatever, and there's very, very little you can do. And you know, we've talked about it before that it puts officials in a quandary. Because, you know, on the one hand, you get this report, you know in your heart of hearts that it's probably one of these fake sort of things, but you still got to respond, which means you got to pull people off the streets and all sorts of other things, and you've got to go there, and you've got to panic the schools because the schools are then going to be evacuated and things like this and freak out the parents. But you have to do it. I understand that. On the, you know, one in a million chance that it's going to be something that's legitimate. So these schools are really held hostage by the people that do it. Well, here's another example. On Saturday afternoon in West Bend, apparently, this is according to a Facebook post, police say someone called and said he killed his family at a particular apartment complex in West Bend around 1:20 p.m., the caller said he was armed with a rifle and awaiting officer's arrival. Okay, so West Bend police get this call. Oh, you know, I've killed my family. This is where I am. I've got a gun. I'm ready. So, you know, what do you do? Well, I mean, you have to take the nuclear response. So the West Bend police respond. The Washington County Sheriff's Office comes. They set up a perimeter. They evacuate several residences in the area. I mean, I guess I understand that. You're living in this apartment complex or nearby. All of a sudden, the police pull up and the cops are going door to door saying, you've got to vacate your house because, you know, we've got a situation there. Well, it turns out that, you know, of course, this was nothing. Officers made contact with the residents, searches the apartment. No victims were found. It was a swatting incident. Somebody made this up in an effort to cause problems for the person that lived there, and by definition also the neighbors and the cops and things like that. I hate talking about problems when I don't have good solutions to offer, or at least solutions to offer, and I don't know what the solution to this is, because when you get a call like this, the cops have to respond. There's no question about it, and you have to take precautions and things like that. But these fake calls, this is happening more and more. It's been a growing problem over the last several years. And unfortunately, because of technology and things of the like, it's much, much, much more difficult to identify the people that are responsible and hold them accountable. So I don't have a good answer, but it's going on, and it's even happening in places like West Bend. Hey, for Bucks fans out there, a tough end, disappointing end to what was otherwise a great season, at least a great regular season. In the context of misery loves company, there's a similar story. Now, I don't know if you're a hockey fan, but this year the Boston Bruins had a legendary regular season, one of the greatest regular season records, if not the greatest of all time. This was just an awesome Boston Bruins hockey team. So they've got the number one seed, all that type of stuff. They look like they're going to be a team for the ages. They go in first round of the playoffs. They're playing the team from Florida. And the team from Florida had just squeaked in. They'd qualified for the eighth seed in the playoffs on like the second last day of the regular season or something like that. The Bruins are overwhelming favorites. The Boston Bruins lost in a 7-game series, 4-3, to the Florida. I think it's the Florida Panthers hockey team. It's just, I mean, it is as much of an upset as the Bucks losing to Miami was. Boston losing to Florida in the NHL was as great, if not a greater loss. And so you have in you know, the teams with the best records in the NBA and the best record in the NHL both can't get out of the first round of the playoffs. I don't know that there's a larger point to this other than misery loves company. When we come back, smoke, smoke, smoke that cigarette, at least for a little while longer. I'll explain. We'll discuss. So, very glad to have you with us. All right. Trying to think of analogies that I could relate to. I am a bourbon drinker. I'm not a brandy drinker. Don't like brandy. Bad experience decades ago with brandy to this day. No interest in brandy at all. But I appreciate that even though it's not for me, that there are other people who like to have brandy and you like your brandy old fashions and you like your brandy Manhattans. And even though you could argue that drinking brandy is not necessarily good for you, I would never say that you shouldn't be able to do that, even though I have no interest myself in drinking brandy. But there's a parallel when it comes to cigarette smoking. And if you're a regular listener to this program, you know that I'm not a cigarette smoker. I have never been a cigarette smoker. I do not understand cigarette smoking. I'm not being judgmental. I'm not. I just don't. I don't get it. It's expensive. We know that there are huge health problems with this, and I particularly don't understand people, especially in the last 15, 20, 25 years, where the evidence has just become more and more clear that cigarette smoking is going to take years off your life. I don't understand why people start smoking. I never get when you walk into a restaurant or a bar in Milwaukee, Wisconsin in the dead of winter, and there's always a bunch of people that are huddled outside because you can't smoke inside anymore, having a cigarette. And you look and there's all these people who are in there, look like they're in their 20s and stuff, and you want it, particularly women, and you want to say, why are you doing this? But I hold my tongue, not trying to be judgmental about that. They've made the decision that they want to smoke cigarettes. One of the things, we've been talking a lot today about the government coming in and trying to make decisions for you. There is a move afoot in this country not to ban cigarette smoking beyond what we've already done, but rather it's to ban certain types of cigarettes. The governor of New York made this one of the mainstays of the budget proposal this year, and she wasn't able to get enough votes. But this is a movement which is happening all across the country, and it's an effort to ban not cigarettes, but ban menthol-flavored cigarettes. Menthol cigarettes, and again, I mean, have I ever had a menthol cigarette? Yes. Was I ever a regular cigarette smoker? No. Menthol cigarettes are widely used by black smokers. Nearly 85% of black smokers consume menthol products. 30% of white smokers consume menthol products. So this is, as far as cigarette smoking goes, it is, and if you want to operate on the premise that it's bad, menthol cigarettes are by far and away the choice in black communities, among black smokers. I don't know why that is, but it is the case. Now, some people argue that it's been decades of aggressive marketing by tobacco companies. That's what's causing black smokers to consume menthol cigarettes. The cooling sensation on the throat makes them more appealing. The flavoring makes them more addictive. So the argument is this has been an effort to target the black community and, you know, create this dependency. And if we walk from the premise that cigarette smoking is bad and that menthol cigarettes are more addictive, et cetera, you've got the problem. Menthol cigarettes account for 1/3 of all cigarette sales nationwide. So 1/3 of all the cigarettes that are sold are menthol, and the overwhelming proportion of smokers who smoke menthol are black smokers. So the argument, Massachusetts has already banned menthol cigarettes. You cannot sell menthol cigarettes in Massachusetts. New York tried to do it, couldn't come up with enough votes. But this is the argument that's now moving front and center. Our number, 855-616-1620. That is the old National Bank talk and text line. Okay, if we agree that cigarette smoking is bad, and we also agree that menthol cigarettes have been targeted for, in this case, the black community, and they're overwhelmingly used by black smokers, and we can agree that that's not good. Guess the question is this an appropriate situation for the government to come in and ban menthol cigarettes? In other words, to say, all right, if you want to smoke those cools, I guess would be, if you want to smoke those cools, you can't. We are going to ban them. 855-616-1620. That's the old National Bank talk and text line. Good idea, bad idea. We discuss in a moment. 855-616-1620, which is the old National Bank talk and text line. I don't understand why people smoke, or at least why they start smoking. I understand it's an incredibly powerful addiction, and this isn't a lecture here, but the idea that we're going to ban a certain type of this product. To me, it's like saying we've got a problem with alcohol in this country, so we're going to ban tequila. All right, but we're going to let you drink brandy and bourbon, or we're going to ban brandy, but you can still drink these other forms. I mean, to me, the ultimate question is, of course, I mean, if you decide cigarettes are so bad that they should be outlawed and you think you can make that work, that's a conversation to have. But to pick and choose and say, okay, we're not going to allow you to have menthol. And by the way, to do it on a state-by-state basis to me is absolutely silly, because all you do is create a black market, because if you're a menthol smoker and your state says you can't have it, well, then you're down in Illinois, for example, and you're buying, you know, cartons and cartons of the menthol cigarettes. Vincent in Lannan. Vincent, you're on WTMJ. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Jeff. I totally agree with you. I don't think it's right that you go after a particular brand of a product. The fact is that there are other avenues you can go. You can go after the companies for basically targeting black communities with these kind of cigarettes. But I understand the fact is this is a specific product, and it boils down to one thing. It boils down to choice, whether you're going to smoke menthol,
yeah,
or you're going to not smoke menthol. Are you going to smoke cigarettes or not smoke cigarettes? So it's a choice. But I understand that when you see what these companies are doing, when they basically flooded the communities with
the free cigarettes and advertising, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, cigarettes, advertising, and things of that sort. I understand you can kind of go after that, but just to go after a specific brand of a product, I think it doesn't solve the problem.
No, thanks. I agree. These are choices that people make. If you want to have an argument about, you know, should cigarette smoking be legal in this country? Like I say, that's a whole different discussion. But to try to pick out certain things, I mean, it's sort of like, where do you draw the line? A couple of our texters are using the example of fast food. You say, okay, we've decided that Big Macs, you know, have too high a calorie content. So, you know, you can't have Big Macs, but you can have like the quarter pounder with cheese or whatever. And I mean, these are individual choices. They are otherwise legal products, and the government shouldn't be if the government wants to come down and say, all right, we're going to try to do everything we can to make sure minors don't, you know, use these products or something. I'm behind that 100%. But the idea of singling out a particular legal product, I don't think so. Rose in Chicago. Rose, you're on WTMJ. Good afternoon.
Hey, how you doing?
Well, thank you. What do you think?
Well, I'm with you. I smoked. I'm an African-American woman. I smoked all of my, majority of my adult life. And matter of fact, I can tell you this. When I started smoking, I was in grammar school, grade school, because my father smoked and my grandfather smoked, and everybody I thought was cool in my family smoked.
Mm-hmm.
My grandfather smoked unfiltered cigarettes.
Yeah, like the Camel Straights, the Camel Straights or whatever. Yeah, sure.
They were unfiltered. I don't know if they were menthol or not, but I tried that. And then my father smoked menthol. I tried that. And so when I got old enough, because, you know, back in the day, you could write a letter to the store, a note from your mom to go buy the cigarettes. So I wrote a note, and I bought the unmenthol.
Right.
And I tried that. So by the time I was 13, I knew I didn't want the unfiltered. Nope, don't like it. I like the menthol. So as the gentleman caller said before, it was a choice. And I didn't need the government to make that choice for me.
Do you still smoke? Do you still smoke, Rose?
No, I quit in 2009.
Okay, I'm curious. What was it that finally caused you to stop smoking?
Oh, I became a nurse.
Okay.
So I figured as well, you know, if I stopped smoking, even though I knew a lot of nurses who smoked, if I stopped smoking, I could probably add some more years back onto my life.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And a bit longer. So that kind of prompted the decision to stop smoking.
Was it hard?
Plus, I didn't like the nicotine was telling me that it was time to go on a smoke break.
Yeah.
I'm like, no.
Was it hard? Was it hard to stop smoking? I got it. Rose, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Thanks for sharing the story. Yeah, I'm certainly not encouraging people to go out and smoke menthol cigarettes. That's the last thing I'm talking about here. It's just the whole notion that if you're going to do this, I think it's a matter of consumer choice. And if you want to target these cigarette companies, or you want to toughen the laws regarding minors smoking or things like that, I'm with you 100%. I just don't think we should pick out particular products, and particularly in this case, particular products that are popular among certain different, you know, parts of the community. And that's where I have the issue. So Wyatt, you're young. Do you have like one of those experiences from your misbegotten boyhood that you just a certain type of alcohol or something that you can't drink just because of that, like, one bad experience?
I don't. My mom does, though. Hers mom. Is tequila.
A lot of people have the tequila stories. Debbie Lozaga. Okay, you just came in to pick up something and
Black Sambuca.
Black Sambuca.
Yeah, it's like black licorice, which was a huge mistake in the first place anyway, because I'm not a fan. But yeah, that it was a misbegotten weekend in the Jersey Shore. So.
I understand it to this day. Yeah, for me, this goes back a long time. But for me, it's brandy that goes. And I, the statute of limitations has long since expired. But this was my misbegotten.
Your lady is not the sea, apparently.
Good. That's the phrase, brandy by Looking Glass. Absolutely.
The body does not have a statute of limitations.
It does. And what's so funny is nowadays I will go out sometime and some of my well-heeled friends will offer me like really expensive cognac and stuff. I mean, really, really good stuff. And it doesn't matter because all I have to do is smell it and it takes me back to... It takes me back to 1970, whatever, in this. And it's like, nah, I don't care how good it is. Trust me, it would be wasted on that. Yeah, yeah. Brandy and... malt liquor also. So brandy and not, I didn't have them together. These were separate experiences, but it continues to haunt me to this day. Just pointing that out. When we come back, as long as we are walking down memory lane, I want to talk about the glory days of an institution that is disappearing as we speak. I will explain. We will discuss. People are texting in their alcohol of non-preference. Couple of people saying peppermint schnapps. Yeah, that was right. Any of that really sweet stuff that you drink in stupid excess that sometimes we do when we're younger. That's the kind of thing that could haunt you. Yeah, peppermint schnapps would be. I can't think of the last time I had peppermint schnapps, and it was probably a long time ago. But yeah, peppermint schnapps would definitely be one of those. Jeff, when I was 15, a friend swiped a bottle of creme de menthe from his grandparents. I'm 70. To this day, neither of us can eat anything mint. about as close as I come is toothpaste. Yeah, there's all those different choices. And it is funny. You just when you're 16 years old, you know, you just don't realize that you are about to make a life-changing decision when you say, yeah, here, let's drink that bottle of creme de menthe or whatever it might be. Okay, I want to completely and totally switch gears. Over the weekend, I was watching one of the really great stoner movies of all times, Fast Times at Ridgemont High, you know, with a young Sean Penn. And it's just, if you haven't seen Fast Times at Ridgemont High, it's about a bunch of California kids, high school kids in like their last year of high school. And it's got a great soundtrack, and it's got a lot of people who went on to become, you know, much bigger stars and stuff. But the cool thing about it, the real star of the show is the shopping mall that it is set in, because it's about, you know, these kids and their experiences. And some of the kids work as movie theaters and work as ushers at the movie theater. And some of them, you know, work at some of the different restaurants that are in the shopping mall. But everything that happens is centered around the shopping mall, some in the high schools too. But the shopping mall is the real star of this case. And it just got me thinking. We've talked a lot about, you know, what happened to Northridge Shopping Mall and how it's declined and how it just kind of completely disappeared. And I tell these stories because I remember when Northridge first opened up. And as a kid growing up in the North Shore of Milwaukee, that's where we hung out. I mean, Northridge was where we went. And what would happen is, well, before we were old enough to drive, you know, your parents would pick up a bunch of us and they'd drop us off at Northridge, and then, you know, we'd hang out at Northridge till it was time to go home, and then somebody else's parents would pick you up and they'd take you home. It was just, and you kind of wandered around and had a little bit of money, you had lunch, maybe you went to a movie, you went to all the different stores and stuff like that, but it was just a cool place to hang out. It was sort of like a way of life. There's a story that caught my attention. It was in the Wall Street Journal over the weekend. The headline is "The Glory Days of the American Mall." In the 1980s, malls weren't just planters and parking lots, but a way of life. And in 1982, the mall meant freedom. You were dropped off at noon, picked up at dusk. In the hours between, you were left to roam in the preferred fashion, in a teenage pack. Some started at the sweet factory, then spent the afternoon dipping a hand into the candy bag like a wino with a bottle. Some started at the food court with caramel corn or orange Julius. We all made a point of stopping by the knife shop to examine the throwing stars and the Bowie knives. Fast Times at Ridgemont High was our mall epic, as Apocalypse Now was the epic of the Vietnam War. It captured the mood, and in doing so, told us where we were going and where we had been. If I think of this now, and this is what got me to actually go back and watch Fast Times at Ridgemont High, it's because we're living in the twilight of the shopping mall, which wasn't just a concentration of planters, fountains, escalators, and tundra-like parking lots, but a way of life. In the 1980s, there were around 2,500 malls in America. How many do you think are left? Just take a guess. Just imagine, don't call in, but just imagine a number, you know, in your head. 2,500 in the 1980s. Right now, they're down to 700. So over the course of the last, you know, 40 years or so, you've gone from 7,500 to, from 2,500 to 700. Forecasters expect there to be just 250 in a decade. So essentially by, you know, 10 years from now, you're going to be down to 250 malls. And, I mean, there's a lot of things that are going on. I mean, it's the internet, it's the recession, it's social media, it's COVID, it's computer games, it's all sorts of stuff that's going on. But the shopping mall has just, it's disappeared in many areas, and it's disappearing in others. I mean, just think about the different shopping malls that we had around here, and how many have gone by the wayside. Northridge is gone. Now, Brookfield Square is still there, but it's much different than it was when it was a shopping mall. Where I'm broadcasting from, you know, when it was Grand Avenue, when now we're the Avenue, and there's a couple of retail stores, but primarily this is not a shopping mall anymore. This is, you know, you have the giant food hall, and then you have like office buildings that are there. You have so many of the other places that have closed. You know, the big, you know, Southridge isn't what Southridge used to be. I mean, Mayfair, I mean, still, you know, the classic shopping mall, but I would argue that that's the most typical one around here that still remains, and who knows, you know, how long that lasts. Our number is 855-616-1620, which is the Old National Bank talk and text line. Here is my question. What do you miss most about the traditional shopping malls? You know, the one that we all grew up going to. What is it that you miss most about them? And I understand that there's still 700 left in the country, but that's down dramatically over the last several years. And it's really taken the number of malls around, especially after the recession in 2008, really plunged. And yes, I know that there's still, I mean, they're still shopping. And the big thing is like a lot of the little strip malls. I have a couple of friends who are into commercial real estate. And that's the thing, you know, the strip malls where you've got maybe a haircut, you've got like a Cost Cutters place, and you've got a Jimmy John's, and maybe you've got an exercise place and a couple others. The strip malls are replacing what the malls were. But, you know, the old-fashioned, the traditional shopping mall, what do you miss most about them? And I bring this up because, better enjoy them, because I think not that long from now, you know, if you want to see what or remember what shopping malls were going to look like, you have to go back and watch movies like Fast Times at Ridgemont High or Mall Rats or a couple of the others. What do you miss most about the shopping malls? 855-616-1620. We discuss in just a moment.
Hey, you guys had shirts on when you came in here.
There's something happened to him, man.
Come on, Spicoli, just put the shirts back on.
The ultimate mall movie.
No shirt, no shoes.
No
dice. Right. Fast Times at Ridgemont High. We're talking about the demise of shopping malls. If you're just tuning in the 1980s, there were 2,500. They're down to 700 now. They think there's going to be less than 250 in the next few years. Just a little bit of walk down memory lane. I miss the shopping malls. Joe in New Berlin. Joe, you're on WTMJ. Good afternoon.
Hey there. So I was telling your screener that I grew up in the 80s, worked in the mall, and it was about, like, freedom and expanding your circle of friends.
Yeah.
I went to Whitnall High School, you know, met people from Franklin High School, New Berlin, Greendale, and you just kind of, everybody got along and you met on breaks, and it was like a little, almost like a reality show because, you know, there was always stuff going on, but it was great. I loved it. And I missed out because, or I should say my daughter missed out because they didn't do that. When she was a teenager, people didn't work at the mall. That wasn't like a fun place to be. And it was just a huge part of my life. And it's really too bad.
Where did you work?
I worked at Sears.
Oh, okay. We're America shops.
Sears in the candy department. I don't know if you remember when there was a candy department there.
Yeah, I don't know, but I you know, the candy that I remember in the malls was like Fanny Farmer candy. You know, they used to have like standalone like candy stores and stuff like that. I remember that. So
sure. Well, Sears had an actual candy department across from the hardware department, where we had hot dogs and all this bulk candy that we would measure out for people. And it was just, you met so many people. It was crazy.
Outstanding. Thanks for calling, Joe. My very dear friend, Steve, who's now retired from Harley, he worked at Farrell's. Remember the old Farrell's? They had one of those at Southridge and one of those at Northridge. And he worked at Farrell's, like ice cream parlor and stuff like that. Let's talk to Mike on the Northwest side. Mike, you're on WTMJ. Good afternoon.
Hi, good afternoon, Jeff. What I would miss about the malls is people watching and then the sitting area for benches and stuff like that where you can sit down and your wife goes shopping and you can sit there and do whatever else you want to do and you get credit for shopping with her.
Well, that's it. You know, you talk about people watching. It really was a kind of, it was a great place. You could just kind of sit and watch the world go by and you'd see all sorts of different people and things like that. And at least back then, it was a safe environment. You know, there was security and stuff. I'm sure they had some problems, but you weren't really afraid that there was going to be a shooting that broke out. It was just like, it was a nice way to spend, you know, a couple hours on a Saturday afternoon.
Yeah, it was great to actually have your Christmas shopping done and watch other people scrambling around still.
Thanks for the call, Mike. A number of people are making the same point that our first caller, Joe, did. Jeff, for me, it's easy. I miss working at the mall and all the friends I made at that time of my life. It was incredibly fun. Jeff, department store shopping was like a candy store to me. All the beautiful clothes, touching them, trying them on. I think that there's... You know, all those different elements. Jeff, when I was a kid, I learned how to ice skate at Mayfair Mall. A number of people are remembering that. Mayfair Mall used to have an ice skating ring inside, and it was right next door to an indoor McDonald's, as I recall, because you could, like, get your Big Mac, and you could sit outside, and you could watch people ice skating. It was, you know, you had things like that that were out there. Look, and I know that there's still malls, and there's malls of the Mall of America and things like that, and that's probably going to be around for a while, But the old-fashioned, classic, giant indoor shopping mall, it is going the way of the dinosaur. And when it does, it's going to be too bad. So go back, watch Fast Times at Ridgemont High, watch Mall Rats. And if you're too young to have experienced that time, well, you don't know what you're missing.